accession number 18443, reel 2.
Colonel Shipster, reel 2.
Specific incident. I do remember one specific incident because it was so pathetic. We had been halted for about an hour and a half, and we were at a culvert, just a small crossing, a small bridge running over a small river, which of course at that time of year was dry. And I remember looking down into the river bed, which, and seeing a bullock cart turned over and a family of some four or five people sitting astride the shafts and weeping. And I remember clearly getting some of our own soldiers, seven or eight of them, to go down, give them what rations we had, and in some small way help them to mount the side of this culvert and get on the road. And the sad thing was that we couldn't help them anymore. The bullock itself, although alive, was obviously dying. And what happened to that family and how they got on, I don't know.
Any incidents from the fighting that you remember that happened to you on the advance north?
There was no fighting, as I remember it. The North Korean army had, as I've already said, somewhat disintegrated. There were stark symbols of the efficiency of American air attacks. There are numerous Russian T-34 tanks which North Koreans used, burnt out along the roadside. There were also a number of SU sugar uniform self-propelled guns which had been dealt with likewise, burnt out by air attack. I can't remember seeing any dead North Korean soldiers, but no doubt there were.
Sugar uniform, did you say?
Sorry?
Sugar uniform? SU, you said, meant sugar uniform?
SU, it was known as the type of self-propelled gun was known as an SU-74. And the same way that the tanks that the North Koreans were using were T-34s. It was just the terminology of the time.
Can you tell me about going into North Korea and the advance towards the Manchurian frontier, please? What you remember of that?
I can tell you a bit about that. The first place of note which interested me enormously was to enter into Seoul. It was like a city of the dead. There were very few civilians about. I can't remember seeing any mechanized transport other than military transport. There were no abandoned buses, cars, lorries or anything of that sort. Completely dead. From there we went a few miles further north and crossed the 38th parallel, where there was a plethora of signs by the roadside, chairs saying, those saying, you're crossing the 38th parallel by courtesy of the American 1st Cavalry Division, General Hobart Gay Zone. So our soldiers promptly put up another sign saying, you're crossing the 38th parallel by courtesy of the Middlesex Regiment, in brackets Diehards, which was our regimental nickname. There were these numerous signs everywhere. There was great continual reference on the road to Kilroy. Quite who this mythical person was, Kilroy, I don't know, but Kilroy was everywhere. Kilroy slept here. Kilroy was here yesterday. Kilroy's gone ahead. I never met Kilroy, But we did meet him again when we retreated southwards. I look upon him as a kindly figure, actually. Not of ridicule.
Did North Korea seem to be much different from South Korea?
Same dreary landscape. The answer geographically is that imperceptibly the country did change. It was hillier as we went north, and certainly when we got as far as Pyongyang, the country was changing. But what was changing more than the country was the climate. It wasn't slowly getting colder. The change in climate came in one night. The Siberian winds from the north came down and the temperature in Fahrenheit dropped about 40 degrees in one night. And as we were in our jungle green uniform, it hit us very hard. The climate was more apparent than the topography.
Was Pyongyang also a city of the dead?
Pyongyang was, I thought, going to be a place of considerable interest. It proved to be otherwise because it had been patterned bombed by large forces of high-altitude bombing, and it was virtually flattened. We were hoping in the Commonwealth Brigade being ourselves and the Argylls, and at that time we had been joined by the 3rd Australian, Royal Australian Rifles. We were hoping that we would be the first troops to enter Pyongyang. And I remember standing by the roadside and being stopped by an American general, 3-star, sitting in a jeep with a driver, unarmed, so it seemed, with a cocker spaniel, a pedigree cocker spaniel, sitting on the seat beside him. And I said, "Good afternoon, General. Can I help you?" And he said, "Say, what plans have we got to enter Pyongyang?" I thought, what an extraordinary thing to say to me. I was then a major again. "What plans have we got to enter Pyongyang?" I said, I didn't know that there were any plans for entering Pyongyang. He thereupon drove off. I never saw him again, never heard. I don't know who he was. The reality was that the South Koreans were the first to enter Pyongyang. It wasn't the Commonwealth Brigade. And when we got there, there were South Korean troops already in the city. How they got there first, God knows, because there wasn't efficiency on their part. At least I don't think so. And they had very little transport. Anyway, there wasn't time to inquire.
Did you go right up to the Chinese frontier?
We didn't go right up to the Chinese frontier. We pulled up short about 15 miles at a place called Anzhou, 15 miles from the Yellow River, which is the border line. It was a tedious advance. Commonwealth Brigade at this time was leading the advance of the whole American army on that sector. It took a sort of routine pattern that an infantry company would lead with American American pattern tanks, and if the country was very close, the vegetation and small hills, then the infantry would lead and the tanks would follow up. But if it was more open, then it was vice versa. The tanks led and the infantry came up behind. We worked together mutually. It was slow going, and on average we would make about 10 or 15 miles a day. I remember stopping short of the Manchurian border. I suppose it must have been about 25 miles short, to be told that an American regimental combat team was going to be coming through us. And I was very relieved to hear this, because I had a premonition that things weren't right. I can't say what it was, and I'm not saying it now with hindsight. I just knew that things weren't going quite right. They arrived, we, as I say, were making about 15 miles a day. An American combat team came up at night with all their headlights blazing on their vehicles. And I remember thinking to myself, they're bound to get shot up and have heavy casualties as they go on up the road. I was amazed to hear about 6 hours later that they had motored 20 miles unopposed.
Can you tell me about your first knowledge of the Chinese coming in, please?
Yes, I can. I remember meeting Colonel Andrew Mann on the roadside, and he said, there's something odd going on up here. Well, I said, Colonel, I think there's something odd going on, not only up there, but all around us at the moment. He said, there's been a number of American F-8 Shooting Stars attack aircraft strafing a hill up there, and they must have been doing it for some reason, and I would like you to take a patrol up and see what's... He didn't say what's cooking up there, he said see what's happening up there. And I went up, and there on the ground were some 14 or 12 soldiers, the like of which I had not seen before. They were very much bigger, and they had fur hats on. And they were the first visible sign that we had had that China had entered the war. I came back down the hill and told him that what I had seen, but I couldn't say that they were Chinese. In fact, I didn't know that Chinese were coming into the war at that point. No sooner that we started talking than all our radios burst into activity that China had entered the war. And orders were given immediately by American High Command to about turn and move back southwards along what the Americans termed were escape routes. This always amazed me, the lack of psychology, a good psychology, to give troops moving southwards, away from the enemy, an escape route.
How did you feel about this new development, about going back south again?
Well, as a professional soldier, I was quite relieved to be going southwards in some ways. But I wasn't relieved in the style in which we were doing it. I could see that there were going to be problems giving soldiers escape routes, and it was very easy to develop into a bit of a turmoil, a bit of a fiasco, with units fighting for their own survival to get away first, which is in fact what happened. The American 8th Army their withdrawal did in fact, I regret to say, turn into a rout, unnecessarily so.
What incidents can you recollect on the move back south?
I must take a rest. I think you can appreciate that our own nerves were somewhat frayed at this stage. We knew we were going south, we didn't know how far. And our information, as always, concerning the enemy was extremely poor. I remember one incident where we had American transport allotted to us to carry us on road movement. And as was the case always with transport companies, so it would seem, the drivers were black. They were nice fellows, very cheerful, but they had one intention only, and that was to get the hell out of it and get back as quickly as possible, regardless of whether we were in the transport or not. So we had to put guards on the transport to ensure that they remained with us. I remember a case where I watched two American truck drivers who had taken up a position in some bushes covering the transport, and their conversation went something like this. "Hey man, did you see that bush move?" Second black man says, "Hey rasters, that bush move." And then a third one came and he said, Sambo, did that bush move? And then all three in unison said, "God, that bush did move. Let's get the hell out of here." And that was a very typical sort of feel of that was around. I don't wish to malign them too much, but it wasn't very conducive to good morale on our part.
Did you have problems as a company officer in maintaining morale in your own unit?
None at all. Never. Can't remember. It's not a conceited remark. I can't remember any problems at all, ever. We realized that maybe there are many soldiers who had doubts, as we all had, but we knew that our survival depended on our cohesion and our keeping together and keeping strict discipline. There's no question of that.
On this move back south, were there any occasions when the battalion or any part of it was in danger of being cut off?
Oh, very much so. There was an incident when we were moving back from the area of Anjou back to a large river called the Chong Chong River, where my own company had been given no orders or received no orders of when to move. We had taken up a position in a dried out riverbed. It was snowing, bitterly cold. But visibility was moderate. One could see about 700 or 800 yards. My company sergeant major came to me and said, "Look over there, sir." I looked over there, and there was a seemingly endless column of Chinese passing by us, about half a mile away, all with their headdress spiked with cut-down branches, and their uniforms spiked with vegetation that they had cut to conceal themselves. It was just as if Dunsinane Wood was going to... can't remember where it was going to.
This is Macbeth.
From Macbeth. I didn't really know what to do. We couldn't fire at them, and the only thing to do was to sit tight. They passed us. I don't know how many thousand people were in the column. It seemed endless. Whether they saw us or not, I don't know. I imagine they didn't. They passed by, and it was part of the main Chinese army moving southwards. There must have been many incidences where we passed each other at a whisker's length.
Did your own company suffer casualties on this move back south?
Well, I can't remember what casualties occurred when and where. Most of them were sporadic patrol actions and so on. I can give you the total casualties in the battalion were 120 killed and wounded, which for the operations we were in was relatively low.
By the time you were moving back south, were you already with C Company, or was that still to come?
I was commanding C Company. I was a company commander again.
Was C Company much different from B Company?
I don't think there are any differences between the companies. If there were, the main difference was that each company thought it was the best, which is a healthy sign. I would say that they were all equally good. And morale was maintained because people realized the importance of obeying orders and sticking together.
Were you still coordinating with the Argylls?
Yes, we were always coordinating. They were really brothers in arms, and we were always pleased to see them and they were us as also we were pleased to see the Royal Australian Rifles. There was a great camaraderie within the Commonwealth Brigade.
Did you come back through Sewell again?
I certainly did. There's no way, other way than, in fact, as far as I can remember, no way of getting round Sewell. It commanded the two main bridges over the Han River and the route southwards, up the way we had come some 8 or 9 weeks previously, going northwards.
Was it still the City of the Dead when you went back through it?
It had been quite a lively city, or rejuvenated itself. And then it died again when the withdrawal southwards proceeded. It so happened, and quite why, I don't know, that the Commonwealth Brigade acted as the rear guard covering the withdrawal of the American forces through Sewell. And it was quite recently, maybe 4 or 5 months ago, I thought I'd ask Colonel Andrew Mann, who's still alive, why it was that the Commonwealth Brigade acted as rear guard. And he gave me this answer, that the American divisional commander asked the British Commonwealth Brigade to act as rear guard because they'd got a lot of experience in this type of operation. So, my battalion, along with the Argylls and the Australians, covered the withdrawal through Sewell. I remember on the last night, sitting on the hills with no bedding, with my soldiers, of course, and all the other company commanders and so on, doing likewise, and being frozen almost stiff. I could hear firing coming away further northwards with Chinese advancing, and I remember thinking, am I going to get out of this alive or not? I can't move down of my own volition. And I wondered when the orders would come to withdraw, and I got them about 9 in the morning to pull down off the hill. We had had no hot food, and came down into Sewell. The place was dead, and we made our way to the river, where I was very relieved to see some tanks. I think they were from the Inniskillen Dragoon Guards, who were guarding the bridge, and had come over with 29 Brigade, a reinforcement brigade, in an earlier phase of the operations. And somebody came up to me on the bridge and said, is your name Shipster? And I said, yes. And he said, I've got a parcel here for you. He gave me a parcel, and it was a parcel from my dear wife in Hong Kong, who I had previously written to, and said, if you're going to send me anything out here, I would particularly like some pâté de foie gras and some caviar. I opened the package, and inside was a tin of caviar and some pâté de foie gras. I shared the contents with the troop leader and a sergeant and a gunner, corporal. I thought how strange it was, eating pâté de foie gras on the bridge over the Han River, literally almost one of the last people to be out of Sewell.
What kind of physical state were you and the soldiers in by this time?
We were, in general, pretty good. I can't complain of the rations. Although we had extremes of climate, the American army fed well. Sometimes we thought too well. And our morale was pretty high. I'm not certain that everybody would agree with my comments, but that is the way I saw it.
And after Sewell, when did the retreat eventually stop? How did the retreat eventually stop, as far as you remember?
Well, I go back in time before we got down to Seoul. It was north of Seoul that we were told that General Walker, commander of the American 8th Army, was going to come up to us to present us with a medal for the defense of the Nakdong Bridgehead. I particularly wanted to have this medal, not through pride or anything, but merely because it was such a strange medal. The medal ribbon looked like two copulating whales, and I rather fancied myself wearing this medal. We never received it because Hiram H. Walker, the army commander, was killed in a jeep crash and never arrived. He, within 24 to 48 hours, was replaced by General Ridgway. And it was the arrival of General Ridgway to the American 8th Army to take over command that a transformation began to take place. It's quite incredible. One can visibly feel it, confidence ebbing back. I never saw Ridgway, and I never saw Walker, but I know Walker was a disaster, and people felt it, and I know that Ridgway was greeted with enormous enthusiasm.
Did you actually meet Ridgway yourself?
I never met him. I can give you an analogy. I spent a long time in Burma, and I never met General Slim. But we all felt we knew Slim. We used to call him Chacha Slim, Chacha being uncle. There's a general feeling of goodwill towards him. And he had an enormous effect on the 14th Army in Burma. Ridgway had the same sort of effect on American soldiers. He lit them up, gave them back something that they'd lost, some pride, some self-esteem.
When did your unit eventually get a rest from this continual movement?
Well, we never seemed to ever get rest at this stage. We were junketing about all the time. We no sooner had we gone through Seoul than we were once again joined what the Americans call the big bug out, going south, endless columns, moving transport, difficult to get any information. And we eventually found our way about 50 or 60 miles south of Seoul, where for me the war ended, because I went back from there to Hong Kong, being posted to our School of Infantry as an instructor.
What do you feel now in 1998 about having served in the Korean War?
I'm extremely glad to have done it. It's an experience I wouldn't have missed, really. I'm a professional soldier. I'm glad to have had that experience. I had all the elation of chasing a beaten army and all the misery of being a beaten army, part of a beaten army ourselves. Two different states of emotion, really.